You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Labor Department adjusted their figures, as they pretty much always do a week or so after the numbers come out, and then they've had a chance to go back and look. And yes, President Obama has created net new jobs. Not only has he dug out of the hole that George W. Bush created, which echoed into the first few months of his administration, but he has created jobs in addition to that, which is something more than George W. Bush could say. And when Bush ended his presidency, he was at zero. No new jobs in 8 years. Obama is now at, you know, it's a couple hundred thousand, but it's a start. He's creating new jobs. Meanwhile, though, a question. Should Anderson Cooper and maybe the senior management of CNN be in Gitmo? Now, follow me on this. I realize that sounds pretty outrageous, but yesterday Assange spoke to the UN. I mean, since June, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has been holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London because he's trying to avoid extradition to Sweden. And the reason he doesn't want to go to Sweden is because he's got pretty good evidence that they intend to send him to the United States, where he would meet the same fate as Bradley Manning or even worse. His crime? In my opinion, being a journalist. You know, there's only one industry specifically mentioned in the Constitution. Literally, there's only one. Now, keep in mind, when this country was founded, there were a lot of really important things. I mean, we needed cannons and musket balls, and we needed paper for newsprint, and we actually subsidized paper for newsprint, but it's not in the Constitution. There's only one industry that the founders of this country, the framers of the Constitution, thought was so important that it should be mentioned by name. It wasn't building battleships. It wasn't making flags. It wasn't making uniforms for the Continental Army. None of that. It's right here. Congress shall make no, it's for the First Amendment. It was ratified December 15th, 1791. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. No law abridging the freedom of speech or the press. The press is the only industry mentioned in the entire Constitution of the United States. Journalism. It's the tool that we the people have to keep our government in check and to make sure that we the people have all the information we need to be informed members of a democracy. The press, the Fourth Estate, it's absolutely essential, which is why it's named and protected in the very First Amendment in our Bill of Rights. Journalism has taken a lot of different forms over the centuries, adapting to technology and changes in our society, you know, from the quill pen to the printing press to radio to television, now to the Internet. In every single case, journalism has utilized all of these methods to do its job, to speak truth to power. But it's that last method, the Internet, that really frightens power. And it's that last method, the Internet, in which WikiLeaks exclusively operates. The reach and speed by which information can be distributed now, thanks to the Internet, is unprecedented. It's revolutionary. It's revolutionizing the world. Now, in a matter of seconds, a story of official malfeasance or even official good deeds can fly at the speed of light to billions of people around the planet. President Obama may have laid some groundwork for the Arab Spring by going to Cairo in 2009 and basically telling the Arab people to tear down their dictators. I've mentioned it a lot of times on this program. But WikiLeaks journalism is what really lit the fuse. WikiLeaks released information about how the president of Tunisia, this kleptocrat, this thief, had been engaging in decades of massive greed and corruption. 2 weeks later, young street vendor set himself on fire, sparking the revolution in Tunisia. WikiLeaks released information about the greed and corruption of kleptocrat Muammar Gaddafi and his sons in Libya. And just like clockwork, that country was well on its way to being swept up in revolution. It was WikiLeaks that released information about Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak's plan to never leave office, even though there were so-called presidential elections coming down the road. And as a result of that WikiLeaks data dump, half a million people were occupying Tahrir Square demanding a revolution, one that they eventually got. That's the power of journalism in the internet age, and none of it would have happened without WikiLeaks. Which brings us to why Julian Assange is stuck in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. He's wanted not by Arab nations. They've seen firsthand the damages revelations can cause to established regimes, but many of those established regimes are now gone. He's wanted by us, by Western powers, principally the United States and, you know, our buddies like Sweden. I mean, let's face it, WikiLeaks is in part the 21st century version of what the New York Times was two centuries ago. Both entities receive information from whistleblowers. Both entities publish that information. In fact, the New York Times published much of the exact same information that WikiLeaks did. But nobody there is going to jail. They haven't been the subject of federal investigations. Prominent lawmakers and government officials are not calling the editors at the New York Times enemies of the state, which is the phrase that they just applied to Julian Assange. No one is declaring CNN's Anderson Cooper a terrorist for reporting on what could be state secrets found in Libyan Ambassador Chris Stevens' personal journal. Remember that video that WikiLeaks exposed showing our helicopter pilots gunning down, I believe they were Al Jazeera journalists or Associated Press, one or the other. There were a couple of journalists there in Iraq. It went viral around the world. It was a war crime right there in front of all of us, committed by our people, terribly and tragically. You know, we the people have the right to know when our government engages in war crimes, whether or not our government decides to label the video top secret. We absolutely have a right to know, which is allegedly why Bradley Manning, who is apparently just as concerned about all this as all of us should be, allegedly posted it on WikiLeaks. That's journalism. That's not espionage or treason. Getting stories like that out there is journalism in literally the purest sense of the word. Yet Julian Assange, giving a speech to the United Nations, goes through a list of U.S. government agencies that are currently investigating WikiLeaks.
Those government agencies identified so far as a matter of public record having been involved in this investigation include the Department of Defense, CENTCOM, SOUTHCOM, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the U.S. Army Criminal Investigation Division, the United States Forces in Iraq, the 1st Armored Division, the U.S. Army Computer and Crimes Investigative Unit, the CCIU, the 2nd Army Cyber Command.
So what's really going on here? Julian Assange is a political prisoner in the West today because the most paranoid within the U.S. government are afraid that they could be embarrassed or maybe even prosecuted for war crimes. And they have this fear for a good reason. Our government is no longer solely the property of we the people. It's now also, in large part, thanks to the Supreme Court, owned in part by the transnational corporate elite and their military-industrial complex. Our media belongs to the corporate elite, just a handful of corporations who own pretty much everything we see in the news media. In Europe, unelected technocrats and banksters have taken over what used to be democratic governments. And one of the few forces out there that hasn't yet been totally brought down by this corporate coup d'etat in the Western world is WikiLeaks. That's why they're a threat to those in power, including those in corporate power. Journalists have always been the underdog in their efforts to speak truth to power. They've been censored, they've been smeared, they've even been murdered. This is nothing new. John Adams, second president of the United States, shamefully shut down opposition newspapers and jailed their editors in the biggest event of his presidency, the passage of the Alien Sedition Laws. Back then in 1798, Thomas Jefferson left town in protest. Historically, our press has been really important. We can't see it marginalized now.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
But marginalizing it is, in fact, what this is all about, this persecution of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. And we need to stand up on his behalf. Fair, only slightly unbalanced. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk media for the sane among us. Remember what the American dream used to mean? I do. It used to mean working hard, keeping your nose clean, and getting enough of a paycheck so you could raise your family, meet all the essentials you need. You know, we went through this a couple days ago. It's worth repeating. Be able to take a vacation every now and then, afford a quality retirement. If you wanted to be really successful, climb to the highest rungs of the American ladder. It used to mean coming up with an idea and starting a small business where there's a local shoe store, appliance store, travel agency, repair shop. It used to mean hiring local members of your community to build that business and eventually passing that business on to your kids and those employees, you know, staying there long enough to get retirement and maybe their kids working for you. Remember Main Streets and cities across America before Reagan? I realize many of you are not old enough to remember. Ask somebody who is. You will be astounded. Or go back and look at some of the old movies, you know, Netflix or whatever. You can see these old TV shows from the 60s and 70s. America was completely different. They all look completely different, full of their own unique shops, boutiques, all employing local workers, making good paychecks so they could spend money at other local stores and keep the local economy thriving. That used to be the American dream. And then something happened. That something was Reaganomics. Specifically, changes in our antitrust laws and our tax code that opened the way for corporate predators like Bain Capital. Bain Capital's business model would have been a crime in the 1970s or at any other time in American history, by and large. Reagan legalized it. That gave the way to transnational corporations that devoured local shops on Main Street by undercutting them, using cheap labor abroad, tax loopholes, massive government subsidies. Look around Main Street today. They all look the same. Everywhere you go, Walmart, Best Buy's, McDonald's, Olive Garden, Burger King. I mean, you know the list. Those local businesses from yesterday, they're gone. Or occasionally some brands survive, but they're actually secretly owned by PepsiCo. Those good paychecks that recycled wealth through the local economy, they're gone. Everybody's working for burger flipping wages, except a few teachers. And you got the whole Republican Party screaming, "Oh, look at that, they're making too much money." And then came the leverage buyout artists and the hostile takeover hustlers, who eventually got so much bad press, LBO and hostile takeovers, that they changed their industry's name. They officially changed their name to private equity, or as I refer to it, pirate equity. It was the opening for corporate predators who created a new business model wherein billions were made simply by harvesting local companies, sucking all the wealth out of them, and then discarding their bones or selling them for scrap. Here's how one of those predators explained how it was done back in 1985, right after Ronald Reagan made it legal.
Bain Capital is an investment partnership which was formed to invest in startup companies and ongoing companies, then to take an active hand in managing them, and hopefully 5 to 8 years later to harvest them at a significant profit.
Sound familiar? That was Mitt Romney, 1985. Harvest them for a significant profit. Yep, he just said that. Harvesting is usually a term reserved for farming when you're, you know, ripping the crops out of the ground, removing the grain or fruit of value, and like Bain did with our middle-class workers and factories, throwing everything else away. Or burning it in the fields. It's a term used to describe inhumane third-world regimes that harvest human organs. It's a term used to describe the plot lines of sci-fi movies when aliens harvest humans. It's a term Mitt Romney used to describe what his company was created to do to local economies. Romney's not a job creator. By his own admission, he's a profit harvester. And today, all that money he's made harvesting the money in what were once our local economies is being used to finance his run for the White House to be the harvester in chief. I mean, really, that's what it all comes down to. The American dream is, I mean, it's toast. I told the story of my dad and how, you know, through largely because of the GI Bill, he was able to go to college. He didn't graduate because my mom got pregnant with me. He got a good union job or a good job in a union shop. Lansing Tool and Die Sinking, worked there for 40 years, died owning his own home. He had a new car every 3 years, a good GM car at that. made just up the street from him. They made the parts for them at Lansing Tool and Dies there. They made the dies that made the parts. And I had the American dream, too. I mean, it was amazing. It was just, you know, I look back on it, it was just amazing. In 1957, when Sputnik went up, Dwight Eisenhower went nuts and said, okay, let's find, you know, gifted kids in America and really give them a shot. And myself and another friend of mine were pulled out of our elementary school, not literally pulled out, but selected out and said, you can learn as much as you want, as fast as you can. And by sixth grade, we were like, you know, we were college level pretty much everything. And then next summer, I got this summer scholarship to go to Michigan State University. And then, you know, went to junior high school. And in the midst of that, the Vietnam War started and everything fell apart. The money for gifted kids went away. So 10th grade, high school, I was hating it. I was bored silly. I eventually got basically thrown out of high school in the 10th grade. Took a GED, scored the 97th and 98th percentile right across the board, which got me into Lansing Community College, where I eventually dropped out of there, too. Why? Because I had started a business in East Lansing, Michigan, that by that time had 5 employees, and I was making more money than my dad was. And I've been an entrepreneur ever since. Literally ever since. Ever since I was 17, 18 years old. And that's the American dream, too. And increasingly, it's dead.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Do you really think that somebody who was a high school kickout and a college dropout today could start a series of businesses, make a good living, raise kids, have a successful family?
And when asked about the jobs destroyed, you definitely took a pass, and you just said you were proud of your money. Proud of your money, and you're so vain. You think you can avoid all your taxes. You're so vain.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Talking about the American dream, talking about opportunity, talking about being willing to step out. And in part, I got to tell you, my own personal story. You say, kicked out of high school in the 10th grade. And in fact, the way I could get the only reason I could take the GED is because they got a court order preventing me from coming back in. It was that bad, seriously. And thus I could go to college when my peers were going to 10th grade. But the point is that, you know, how did I get there? How did I get to the point where, you know, you could do that? It wasn't, you know, like some miracle. I've told this story to my kids so many times, and others. My peer in this, I'm going to change his name because I'm pretty sure that I've got all these details right, but I may have some little tiny detail. You know, there might be some little piece of it that's wrong because, after all, it's been a lot of years. 57 was a long time ago. But my recollection is it was 56, 57. I think it was 57 when Sputnik went up. And in fact, you know, we could hear it in our classroom. One of our teachers had a shortwave radio, and you could hear this thing go bing, 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 bing as it went across the sky, and it just terrified America. And Eisenhower said, okay, we've got to do something. We've got to create a generation of engineers and scientists. And so they came into I don't know if it was all the schools, but they certainly came into our school, the school that I was in elementary. I was in second grade. And they came into our school, and we all had to take these kind of standardized tests, as it were, to figure out if we were smart. And myself and one friend of mine, we'll call him Jerry, were pulled out of our class and basically told, okay, you go to class, my recollection is half the day, half the time, and half the time you can, you know, sit in this room and just study anything you want, and this, various teachers or counselors or whatever will be available to answer questions or help you out, and you'll have access to the library and all that kind of stuff. And by the end of sixth grade, I was reading at college levels. I was doing math. I was starting trig. I was starting to understand trigonometry. I'd been through algebra and geometry. Had some vague notion of what calculus was. I had read a number of the classics. I had had 2 years of Spanish. I'd had 2 years of Latin. I mean, all that stuff, right? And I was 12. And in the middle of this, when I was around 8 or 9, Now, my friend Jerry, his dad was a psychologist. My dad worked in a tool and die shop. But my friend's dad was a psychologist, and he had this whole library of psychology books at home. And we used to just love reading these things. My two favorites were, one, this book on the Rorschach test, which I'm going to tell you about, and the other was by Richard von Krafft-Ebing. It was called Psychopathia Sexualis. And if you are old enough to remember when that book was around, it's probably still around. I mean, it was written like in the early 20th century, maybe late 19th century, and it was about sexual weirdnesses. But in any case, we had this, my friend Jerry had this, his dad had this book on the Rorschach test. So we read this book on the Rorschach test, how it worked. And we were like, wow, that's fascinating. And it was particularly fascinating to us because four times a year, as I recall, might have just been twice a year, but it was a couple times a year, the school counselor, who was this sweet little 23-year-old who had just graduated from college with her degree in school counseling, and she was just all so enthusiastic. I mean, just, you know, central casting first grade teacher, right? I mean, she was just this sweetheart. And she would come in and she would sit my friend Jerry and I down in separate rooms and give us the Rorschach test to see if our little minds were being twisted by all this knowledge that was being crammed into us. Because it was an experiment. Nobody had ever done this before. So we read this book, and Jerry and I said, hey, let's do this. And he was like, okay, I'll take violence, you take sex. And I'm like, okay, cool. So we went in, and she comes in, and she says, so what do you see in this ink blot? The Rorschach test is the ink blot test. She said, what do you see in this ink blot? And I'm like, what are they doing behind that keyhole? And, you know, she shows me the next one, and she says, what are they doing in this? You know, what's going on in this ink block? And I said, shouldn't they have clothes on? And, you know, in the next one, you know, I genuinely don't remember my exact answers, but there were variations on these, you know. Are you sure a little kid like me should be seeing pictures like this? And, you know, that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, and my friend Jerry was, you know, oh, the blood, how did that blood get all, you know, and is that his, are his brains on the floor, you know, and stuff like that. She was so horrified. Now, we didn't realize at the time. We, you know, because she just kind of kept an even face. I mean, that's how you do it when you do the Rorschach test. And we had no idea if we got her or not. And about 5 days later, my parents, my dad, came to me and said, your mom and I and you are going to school for a conference tonight. And he did not sound happy. And I was like, uh-oh. So we go to this conference, and there's Jerry and his dad and mom, and me and my dad and mom, and the principal and the vice principal and two of my teachers and the school counselor. And the school counselor says, basically, sorry to break bad news to you, but, you know, the Rorschach tests are showing that your kids are being really badly influenced by something, and we're concerned that it might be, you know, what they're learning in school. Is there anything else in their home environment that could be doing this? And they were all just, like, taking this so seriously. And finally, Jerry and I are like, you know, it was a joke. We read this book on the Rorschach test. We punked you. And she was totally not buying it, right? I mean, her reputation was on the line. She was totally not buying it. She was like, no way. And we were like, yeah, you know, we just made that stuff up. She says, you know, come on, you're 8 years old. You're not smart enough to make this stuff up. Or 9 years old, by the way. However, well, you know, it was early. And finally, you know, well, not finally. I mean, it was just a few sentences into it. My friend's dad speaks up and says, I have a book on the Rorschach test at home. And Jerry says, yeah, that's the one we read. And it just kind of all falls apart. And this poor counselor, this poor guidance counselor, she just gets this look like, you know, that's it. And in fact, we never saw her again. I don't know if she lost her job, and I still feel guilty to this day if she did, or if she just went to another school, or if they just gave up on testing us, because I, you know, they may have continued testing us. I have genuinely no recollection of it. But the point is that back then, and I wrote an op-ed piece about this. If you Google my name and gifted students, you'll probably find it. It was maybe a decade ago I wrote it, that some incredibly small percentage of our federal and state budget goes to gifted children in the United States. It's something like 0.0001%. I mean, it's a fragment compared to the part of our budget that goes to kids who are trying to catch up. Now, I'm all in favor of giving a lot of money to kids who are trying to catch up. and helping them achieve their potential. But there are a lot of gifted kids out there, a lot of really smart kids out there who don't need to go through 12 years of high school. I mean, we saw this in our own family. Our youngest kid, we homeschooled for the last few years. And she ended up, you know, much like I did, you know, taking a GED and go straight into college while her peers were in high school. And, you know, I think that those, as you've heard many times, I'm not a fan of charter schools. I think that charter schools paid for with public money are a way of destroying public schools. That said, I think one of the huge areas that we're missing in our public school system is our gifted kids. We're not providing them with the resources that they need to become everything they could be. And by the way, they do provide those kids with those resources in Denmark and in Singapore, the two countries that rank highest in the world in outcomes, in educational outcomes. And increasingly they are in other countries around the world. And we're not. We're still fighting battles over whether we're going to pay unionized teachers in Chicago a decent salary, or whether a third of the schools having no libraries is too many or not enough. Do you get how far we've come? I mean, that was I'm comparing 1958, 1959 to today. And I realize, you know, there's probably, especially for those of you who are much younger than me, you know, a certain element of, listen to the old fart complain about the good old days. But it was real. Eisenhower and Jack Kennedy actually were committed to building a nation of scientists and engineers. And then Kennedy took it a step further based on the foundation that Dwight Eisenhower laid in 1957 and said, we will put a man on the moon within 10 years. And right now we're in a situation where, you know, if Barack Obama got up and said, we're going to send a family to Hawaii, Mitt Romney would stand up and yell, we can't afford it. It's not in the budget. Forget about the moon. Do you get how far we've gone? And how have we gotten this far? By theft. This whole Reaganomics trickle-down theory, this whole Laffer curve, let's cut the taxes on the very rich. Let's cut the taxes on the corporation. Let's start the race to the bottom. Oh, and now that we've cut taxes, we're out of money. Look at this huge deficit. Well, I guess we've got to cut spending. Where are we going to cut spending? Well, let's start with our schools. Gifted kids, to hell with them. Kids who aren't living up to their potential because their parents are homeless, to hell with them. Police officers having good, competent training, high stand. No, we don't need that. Let's close some fire stations while we're at it. Keeping our roads in good, high-speed rail? What, are you kidding? That's French. Do you get my point? I mean, this used to be the American dream. And it's been blown up. And I think, frankly, this campaign actually has a good chunk of that as an undercurrent to it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Go back and watch that 60-minute special. Romney's American dream is, hey, you can go to the ER. And Obama's is, let's have an opportunity for everybody.
Today, over 600,000 people live and work there. He is the only man to ever ace a Rorschach test.
What's that TV show from? It's the Dos Equis commercial. I have seen that commercial. I just haven't seen it enough to have it imprint. That's hysterical. That is hysterical. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. John in Watertown, Mass. Hey, John, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I love your program, and thank you for supporting Julian Assange. That's amazingly important. I'm a social science professor in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. And I really find that what you're doing is remarkable, and thank you for it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your kind words. Was there a specific you wanted to get into?
I also have a question. You know, for example, why do you...
Why do I... we lost his question. I'm sorry. That was not me dropping it. I don't know what happened. Anyhow, Dave in Detroit, listening on WDTW. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Well, I was listening to you earlier, and, you know, this kind of goes along with some of it, that the Republicans are always howling and whining about voter fraud, yeah. And yet nobody has addressed what I think is a much more insidious crime, and that is election fraud.
Yeah.
And I went on, Wikipedia actually has a page labeled electoral fraud, and it kind of defines it and explains it. Mm. And I read most of that, and I mean, it was just like going right on down the list of what the Republicans are doing to limit the voters, you know,
to rig the elections, basically. Yeah,
I mean, it's just one of those deals that it really opened my eyes.
Well,
I mean,
good on them. Really, and now that you've mentioned it, probably one of these right-wing groups will get over there and edit it right out. But, well, you know,
yeah,
time will tell.
One other thing is that the things that they were talking about, the fact that the Pennsylvania governor came out and basically said, you know, we're doing this so we can deliver Pennsylvania for the Republicans in November.
Right.
Wouldn't that in and of itself at least raise the question of, is this or is this not election fraud?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And the problem is that these guys are betting on the fact that, and Karl Rove is doing the same thing with, you know, calling his Crossroads group that's running all these anti-Obama ads a social welfare organization. They're betting on the fact that even if they lose in court, it will be after the elections, after the damage is done. And that's the whole gig. Dave, thank you for the call. Travis in Houston, Texas. It says you want to argue with me, Travis, so you go right up.
Oh,
what's up?
Not too much. I won't argue with you. I dissent with about 95% of what you say, just because we come from different viewpoints. But you're not going to convince me. I'm not going to convince you, so I won't waste your time there.
All right.
But I agree that there's some issues with the way that we stamp college degree required on job requirements in this country. I have a high school diploma. I didn't get kicked out of high school like you did, but I finished high school. And I did about a year of trade school learning how to be a paramedic.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm much younger than you, so this is in today's economy. I worked from about 1997 to 2000 as a paramedic, mm-hmm. went to a hospital and got on-the-job training in a cath lab for about 3 years, and then went to a medical device firm as a clinical specialist for their products. And ever since 2003, it's been basically my job has been teaching physicians on how to use the products and technology that my company utilizes. I worked for three companies in that time,
mm-hmm.
and make a figure somewhere in, you know, my strongest year was 168, haven't been below 130 in quite some time.
All right, so you're in the top 5%. You're doing well. That's good on you. Congratulations.
But,
without
know,
a high school diploma. Is that your point?
Yeah, people come out of college today with all of this college debt saddled with huge burdens that they have to repay.
Yeah.
And a lot of jobs that, you know, say 4-year degree required could be done by an intelligent person with a high school diploma.
Or
if they were given the chance to do
or
that
even a GED. Travis, I totally agree with you. Let me tell you one of the things that I've learned over the years being in business, that one of the ways that HR people think, and it's that college degree that they're looking for is not, they're not looking for evidence that you know anything. They're not looking for evidence that, you know, you've learned something in your particular field. Pretty much every business knows that they're going to have to re-educate you from scratch about their way of doing business and their industry, and things change faster in the real world than they do in college and all those kinds of things. I mean, you know those. I'm sure you'd agree with me on all those points. What they're actually looking for, and I think this is, you know, frankly rather sad, because, you know, back 30 years ago, the average person got, you know, changed jobs every 15 to 20 years. Now the average person changes jobs every 4 to 7 years. What they're looking for in that 4-year degree or even a 2-year degree is proof that you're willing to stick with something. Proof that you have that basically they want, that what they're saying is, prove to me you don't have ADD. You know what I mean? And a college degree is kind of proof of that, and that's why they use that as the first filter. Also, so many people have them, you know, so that's another first filter. Okay, well, you know, if he could get through college, we know he can at least compose, or she can compose a literate sentence, theoretically, you know, should that skill be necessary. And I agree with you. I think it's a tragedy that, A, we don't have trade schools in the United States like most other countries do. In Germany, they make the decision while you're still in elementary school whether you're going to go to college or trade school based on your aptitudes and your intelligence. And it's not a matter of intellect intelligence. It's the, you know, some people have physical intelligence, spatial intelligence. Some people have logical intelligence or mathematical intelligence. Howard Gardner wrote that book, The Seven Intelligences, back in the late 90s, you know, about this kind of stuff. And they decide whether you're going to go into the, you know, gymnasium or the Realschule, whether you're going to go into the college prep high school or the trade school. And when you go to trade school in Germany, it's a serious business. It takes years to become a bricklayer, you know, for example. And if somebody's a journeyman bricklayer in Germany, you can take it to the bank. They've got a career for the rest of their lives, and they know how to make bricks like nobody else on earth. And we should be doing the same thing in the United States. And we used to. You know, the tool and die shop that my dad worked at, to become a journeyman tool and die maker, took years of practice and experience and mentorship. We need to go back to that. Thank you, Travis.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman here with you, 7 minutes past, well, 6 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Nick Gillespie on the line with us from Reason Magazine, Reason.com. He's the editor-in-chief over there. Hey, Nick, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Great to have you back. Forget Romney. We should be concerned that 49% of households get government money. Are you talking about the billions that we give to the oil industry?
You know, that's a problem. That tends not to come to households. But as a libertarian, a small L libertarian, I'm not fond of the government giving money to anybody. In a piece a couple of weeks ago, I talked about the fact that about 49% or about half of American households get direct cash payments.
Right.
From the government, and I do think that that's problematic because in that are a lot of people who don't need that money. These are people who are well into the upper middle class or the wealthy class, and they shouldn't be getting.
You're
money
talking about retired people who are on Social Security or Medicaid,
yep.
Who also
or
have
Medicare,
high wealth or high income.
Yeah. Let's say Mitt Romney. I'm assuming
right.
Mitt Romney.
So what you want to do then, Medicare. Nick? What you're suggesting is let's, as Mitt Romney said on 60 Minutes this weekend, let's means test Social Security and Medicare, turn them into welfare programs so that they're easy to destroy, as Bill Clinton did with the welfare programs of the Great Society.
Yeah, actually, no, that's not what I'm saying. Although that's
well, that's always the consequence of turning of means testing programs.
Wait, Tom. The fact of the matter is that Medicare and Social Security are sold as programs that people supposedly invest in and then simply get back what they put in.
Not true. Not even remotely true, Nick.
Right.
Come on, do your friggin' homework. No, Social Security was sold as old age and disability insurance. In fact, that was the name. That was part of the original name. It was insurance against poverty. In 1935, one of the leading causes of death among people over 65 in the United States in the winter was hypothermia. They froze to death. Social Security was invented as insurance against poverty and old age, and it cut poverty and old age by more than half.
That is certainly not how it is sold now, Tom.
It certainly
it is.
Is.
Certainly not how it is.
Nobody is living off Social Security.
Why do we have dedicated payroll taxes? Why do we get a state
to make sure that those funds actually work?
Can I say something?
Well, if you're going to ask a question, I'll give you an answer.
We have dedicated payroll taxes that supposedly go into a Social Security account. We get a statement from the government telling us what our likely Social Security benefits will be. It is designed to mimic a retirement plan. It is not a retirement plan. The government has said, and the Supreme Court has sanctioned the fact that you have no claim for the money that you pay in Social Security taxes. It's not a retirement account. It shouldn't be taught as
it is old age insurance. And I don't know when those summaries that you're talking about sending out. I don't know which administration started them, but I think it was a horrible idea. I would be willing to bet it was a Republican administration.
Should millionaires get Social Security?
Yes.
Yes or no?
Absolutely.
Millionaires should get Social Security.
Absolutely. They paid into it.
Okay. No, but they didn't pay into
Certainly they paid into
they
it.
They paid taxes. They pay taxes.
On their first $110,000 in income, they paid into it.
What I would argue is that it would be a better system if people who are wealthy enough and able to take care of their health care and their retirement pay for it themselves.
Nonsense. Because then what you're doing is you are stratifying, classifying America.
To cover people who can't pay for themselves.
Because it's a difference based on class distinctions. You are making the royalist argument of these very wealthy people are so wealthy that, the programs that apply to the rest of us shouldn't apply to them because, after all, they're in the Koch brothers league, you know. David Koch is taking Social Security. Why not? Doesn't hurt me.
Because he doesn't need it. It does because Social Security is not paid for out of the taxes
there,
that are collected.
There's fewer than 20,000 people in the United States who make over $1 million a year, Nick. They're taking some Social Security is not going to affect the rest of us, and it doesn't, and you know it.
No, actually, what I'm saying is that, you know, what started, you had me on to talk about, should we be concerned about that? 49% of people live in households that are receiving government money. My short answer to that is yes. We should be for two reasons. And the first is that in order to pay for those benefits, we are broke. There is no way that we can.
We are broke because of Bush's insane tax benefits. Don't you remember Bush's first State of the Union address?
Because of that. We're broke because the historical average since World War II of tax revenue equals 18% of GDP, and the historical spending since World War II has been about 20%. That's why we're broke. We're spending more than we could possibly take in taxes.
Because George Bush
put two wars without putting them on the books because
George Bush created a Medicare Part D drug benefit program
Why shouldn't seniors get free drugs? If they shouldn't get free drugs, then they shouldn't get free health care. Unless they can't pay for it.
Yeah, to hell with them. If they're poor and they're sick, just let them damn die.
That isn't what I said.
This is what George W. Bush said in his first State of the Union address. This is George W. Bush. Here he is.
Many of you have talked about the need to pay down our national debt. I listened, and I agree. We owe it to our children and grandchildren to act now. And I hope you will join me to pay down $2 trillion in debt during the next 10 years. At the end of those 10 years, we'll have paid down all the debt that is available to retire. That is more debt repaid more quickly than has ever been repaid by any nation at any time in history.
That was George W. Bush in March of 2001, and he was able to do that because Bill Clinton had raised that top tax rate without a single Republican vote in the House of Representatives, and with Newt Gingrich claiming it would cause a Great Depression, he had raised that top tax rate on rich people by 3%, and the capital gains rate was not 15%, it was 20-something percent, and therefore we had a surplus.
Bill Clinton cut the capital gains rate. Were you against that?
Eventually, yes, I was.
Okay.
And I'm also against the cuts in the corporate tax rate.
Get back to our current situation.
No, my point is, you said we're broke. I'm saying we're not broke. We got plenty of money. We are the richest country in the world. What we have is a bunch of billionaires who fund right-wing think tanks and who fund right-wing politicians who are refusing to pay their fair share.
Tom, two things. One is that the highest recorded annual rate of taxation as a percentage of GDP was 1 year under Bill Clinton, which went to 20.6% of GDP, an all-time high. He was only able to get there.
Wait a minute. Are you ignoring World War II?
Both Al Gore and George Bush.
Are you ignoring World War II? Are you ignoring World War II?
In recent years.
Oh, so what year are you starting this at? The day that Lord Reagan took office?
No, I'm just saying, and you brought up Bill Clinton, so I was talking about that. It's the last time we had a balanced budget. Right, at least
we actually the last time we had a balanced budget was the Jimmy Carter administration. He produced two balanced budgets. And then Ronald Reagan came along and borrowed in 8 years more money than every president from George Washington to Jimmy Carter combined.
Okay, so to get back to this question, and if we're talking about old age entitlements, because most of the money that people get comes out of Medicare and Social Security, I would argue that it would be a much better world and it would be a much better economy if people who could pay their way do so.
Yes, exactly. Let's lift the cap. Let's say if you earn over $110,000, that income is going to be subject to Social Security taxes.
You're a fan of Social Security. You're a fan that everybody should get Social Security.
Yes.
Let me ask you this. If I was your investment advisor and I said, Tom, you know, when you retire, I'm going to make sure that you're in a plan.
Social Security is not a retirement plan. If you were my investment advisor and you brought up Social Security, I would fire you. Nick Gillespie, Reason Magazine, Reason.com. Nick, thanks for dropping by.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back more here on the Tom Hartman Program, 16 minutes past the hour.
I'll show you just how cool scientists are. We study everything, that's why we're cool. And yes, most of us got high marks in school. And proud.
Well, some of us in elementary school, anyway. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Psychopaths have a poor sense of smell. This is interesting. You know, there's been this long-standing debate in the psychiatric and psychological communities about whether sociopathy and psychopathy are inherited or acquired. And if they're inherited, what kind of adaptive value might they have? And, you know, I've got a lot of speculation on that, which I will not dump on you right at this moment. But one of the things that they have found is that the orbitofrontal cortex, the OFC, is part of the brain that helps process smell, or at least helps make meaning of smell. And smell is, by the way, our oldest and most primitive sense. It's the only sense that is not mediated by the thalamus. There's no volume control on smell. All of our other senses have volume controls associated with them via the thalamus. All, you know, the ears, the auditory nerves, they go into the thalamus, they come out, they go to the occipital and parietal regions. They go to Broca's and Wernicke's region. The nerves from our retina, the optic nerves go to the thalamus, they come out, they go to the occipital region, where we process vision. Our efferent nerves, our tactile nerves, our feeling nerves go into the thalamus. They come out. They go to the sensory motor strip, parietal region, and, you know, where we process feeling. The one part of the brain that is not mediated by the thalamus, which is the giant volume control for the brain. And there's a whole theory around ADD about this that I wrote about in my book, Tom Hartman's Complete Guide to ADHD, in which I suggest that ADD is a deficiency of dopamine, because dopamine helps regulate the thalamus and is associated with low thalamic gain. Not a deficiency as in something's wrong. I think it's supposed to be that way. But in any case, here's this question. Why is it that psychopaths can't smell as well as the rest of us? They took a bunch of people who were high-functioning psychopaths. They were people who were actually, you know, able to function in college and whatnot, but they were the kind of people who, you know, sort of like... like Mitt Romney, who would grab a student and tackle him down to the ground and cut his hair off to make fun of him because he's gay or something like that. Those kind of people. And they found that they didn't smell as well. I mean, they weren't capable of noticing or distinguishing between smells. And they say odor molecules bind to specific nerve cells in the base of the nose, which then send signals via the lateral olfactory tract to the primary olfactory cortex. And there they go to the OFC, the orbitofrontal cortex, via a brain organ called the mediodorsal nucleus, located in the thalamus. But see, that's a kind of a secondary, tertiary leap through the thalamus. And why is this going on? Nobody knows. They also found there's also an olfactory dysfunction associated with schizophrenia, but I think that that is more, what's the name of the disease where you can smell tastes and you can see sounds and you can hear colors? It's synesthesia, as I recall, is what it's called. That's a whole different thing that schizophrenics are more likely to experience. And people who take lots and lots of LSD. Which can be, you know, entertaining for a short while, but anyhow, could that mean that psychopaths are made and not born? And if so, what accounts for the fact that most psychopaths fall into very specific categories? Anyhow, I'll leave that with the rest of that conversation for another time. I find that a tantalizing bit of information that frankly, I'd love to write an entire book around, you know, the speculations associated with that. But I don't think I have time right now. Working on another book right at the moment. Oh, my. Houston in Chatsworth, Georgia. Hey, Houston, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going? I just like to say that, you know, I've talked to you more than I've talked to my congressman and my senator.
Uh-oh.
And that's pretty sad for the state of affairs in America right now.
Well,
thank you for listening to me and taking my call.
Yeah, but you got to be calling your congressman and your senators more often.
Yeah, I know. Well, they're all a bunch of knuckleheads. What can you do?
Well, you still call them. You know, redemption is possible for everybody.
Yeah, well, they say that, but money talks and you know what walks.
So oh, yeah.
That's how it goes in America. And my whole thing is Mitt Romney's 47% he came out with.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to label us victims and that, you know, we're not entitled to food and housing.
Right.
And my whole thing is, in the Constitution, it says pursuit of happiness. How is a regular, middle-class, hard-working construction worker supposed to pursue happiness when we can't even get a piece of bread, a cot, and a roof over our head to help support us? And we have no other recourse but to just sit here and hopefully have someone do something about it. But
yeah.
No one's doing anything about it, and it says right there, pursuit of happiness.
Right. Well, and this is, you know, Franklin Roosevelt in the 40s, I think it was, maybe the late 30s, proposed a second Bill of Rights. I was going to say four freedoms. It's his second Bill of Rights. And his second Bill of Rights said that everyone should have, as a right of citizenship, they should know that they will always have food available to them, they will always have housing available to them, they will always have a job available to them, they will always have health care available to them, And as I recall, there was a fifth thing. I'm not remembering what it was, but say what, Shane? Healthcare, job, house, food, yeah, whatever. Anyhow, maybe it was transportation. In any case, that these are things that we should provide as a society. That if somebody doesn't have access to decent, and to some extent we're doing that, you know, the child school lunch programs. Although the libertarians are opposed to it, and the reason people are opposed to it, you know what? You know, 30 million kids taking food stamps. We can't have that. But I'm with you, Houston. How can you have the pursuit of happiness? Franklin Roosevelt said it very famously in 1936, on July 27, 1936, in Philadelphia, when he accepted his nomination for the party for president. He said, "A necessitous man is not a free man."
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Now, necessitous is not a word we use much these days, although back in 36 they did. It means if you lack the necessaries, you are not free. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Mitt Romney, he's going to harvest companies for their profits. Yeah, right. And meanwhile, the debate's coming up. Both sides are trying to lower expectations. The Obama team is saying, well, Mitt Romney has done 20 debates in the last 4 years, and the president hasn't done one in 4 years. On the other hand, Dan Senior, interviewed by Nora O'Donnell, says this about Romney.
Sounds like you're trying to lower expectations now.
Well, I mean, I'll tell you that President Obama is a very experienced debater. We saw how he did in 2008. And Vice President Biden, I would say, is one of the most experienced debaters in national politics. He's been doing this for decades. He's run for president a few times. So these are very accomplished, experienced men on the debate stage.
Yeah. So if Romney blows it, don't blame him. But here's what Romney has to say. Romney, you know, we have had so many examples through this campaign of projection and transference, particularly projection, where a person or a party accuses the other side of doing what they're doing. So when the other side figures out that they're up to it and calls them out on it, you know, it sounds like, you know, I'm rubber, you're glue, you know, that kind of thing. It just doesn't, it doesn't have the sting. And Romney has, I mean, there are at least 8 or 9 ads. They're so full of lies that Romney has been running that they've gotten pants on fire, you know, things. And the Obama administration, I think they've had 1 or 2 ads where they got pretty badly trashed for the content. And they tend to pull them, but the Romney campaign has been, and in particular, the Crossroads stuff, you know, Karl Rove stuff, full of lies. So what does Romney say is going to happen in the debate? Here he is.
But I think the challenge that I'll have in the debate is that the president tends to, how shall I say it, say things that aren't true. And in attacking his opponents, I've looked at prior debates, and in that kind of case, it's difficult to say, well, am I going to spend my time correcting things that aren't quite accurate, or am I going to spend my time talking about the things I want to talk about? And
in other words, how am I going to deal with the fact that this president's a pathological liar? I mean, that's basically what Romney's saying. I'm wondering how Obama is going to deal with, you know, if Romney uses the things that he uses in his stump speeches. Oh, Obama took $716 billion out of Medicare. No, he didn't. He didn't. I mean, it's just really simple. He didn't. He took it away from United Healthcare and the other health insurance companies and said, we can provide these services cheaper through the government. That strengthens Medicare. It doesn't hurt Medicare. I mean, it hurts United Healthcare. I get it. I understand why their lobbyists are crawling all over the city and why they're helping sponsor ads trashing the president for it. But for Romney to say it, that's a lie. And I virtually guarantee you that's one of the lies that's going to come up in the debate. Now, Paul Ryan suggested pulling that exact same amount of money out for the exact same reason. And I just hope the president doesn't say, yeah, Paul Ryan wanted to do that too, because then Romney's going to say, yeah, but he's not running for president. I am. And that'll be the end of that. We've already been through that, right? We saw that cycled through on 60 Minutes. I hope the president just says that's a lie. It's not true. Romney says he's going to start using Reagan's line. There you go again. Yeah, right. Sorry, Mitt. I didn't know Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan wasn't a friend of mine. Although I do know his son, and I consider his son a friend, and I have probably more respect for Ronald Reagan's son, than, I mean, he's like up in the top 10 or 15 people that I've ever known in my life in terms of the respect that I have for him. And you, Mitt Romney, are no Ronald Reagan, and certainly no Ron Reagan. Mark in Las Vegas. Hey, Ron. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I hope your wife is doing well.
She is. And, in fact, she's all done with the chemo. Her head is starting to get fuzzy. She's very excited about it. She's got more energy than, both of us can deal with. And, it's all good news. So.
Well, good. I am glad to hear that. Hey, regarding Nick Gillespie and Reason Magazine, you know, he missed a point when he suggests that wealthy individuals don't need to depend on Social Security in these programs.
Right.
One of the reasons I think FDR instituted the program for everyone is that, well, everyone would have a stake in it, first of all. And secondly, even millionaires go broke. And if they do, what are we supposed to do, walk by them?
That's a good point. That's a good point. Donald Trump himself declared bankruptcy more than once.
Right, exactly. And the other point I want to make is that when conservatives get on their high horse about people being dependent on government, Last time I checked, there isn't much that we do that actually isn't assisted by government. If you fly, the FAA is there. There's the FDA, the NIH, the CDC if you get sick. You know, who checks on the hospitals and the doctors, you know. And right on down the line,
food supply, you want to make sure that your water is drinkable. You want to make sure that your sewage is being appropriately disposed of before it ends
Absolutely.
Up in the rivers that you and your kids are swimming in.
That's all government.
Yes.
And for anybody to stand up and say that they're self-sufficient is the biggest load of nonsense.
Yes, horse you know? Pucky, I think, is the bull pucky.
Yeah, to be nice about it.
Yes.
You know? So the next time that you get Nick Gillespie on there, ask him if he knows if his gasoline was actually 87 octane and how he knows that. Does he test his own gasoline or does he depend on government?
Excellent point. Thank you, Mark. Thank you very much. I tell you, I've got the smartest listeners on earth. I learn as much from my listeners as they learn from me. That was brilliant. Catherine in Miami, Florida. Hey, Catherine, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a mother of a son with autism, and I heard your information about gifted children. I believe that our civil rights crisis today in this country is really about these special needs kids.
I agree.
And I'm just like stunned at what I face every day because my son for 11 years has been disability profiled over and over. He's verbal now, but he started nonverbal.
Mm-hmm.
And autism, I know you know this, it's so fast growing that it's bigger than diabetes, cancer, and HIV combined,
yep.
according to the website. And I'm always like trying to turn over stones to push my son ahead. He just got into middle school. It was a year from hell last year.
Mm-hmm.
And I just found this blog, I Stand With Henry, about a young boy who's also 11. He's nonverbal, but he speaks with his iPad. He's sitting across the street from his school in Tampa. He took signs about the civil rights movement from 1964 to the RNC and tried to get attention about his cause. All he's trying to do is go to school.
Mm.
And I'm just stunned because I'm realizing, you know, with my son's situation, there's a sea of people out there going through the same thing and we're not being heard.
Yeah.
One other quick thing I just wanted to tell you because I know I don't have a lot of time is that I got so upset last January that I actually wrote President Obama and Temple Grandin and a million other people, but it took 4 months, but President Obama actually responded.
Hmm.
And he had a staffer call my house and talk to me about my son.
Wow.
And I just wanted to say that it was so touching because, you know, it's very symbolic for us that my son have a voice. And it's just amazing. So we keep trying to get our information out there. My son's speaking next month at TED Talks, mm-hmm. down here at the Cushman TED Talks. And,
great.
You know, I just really appreciate you bringing light to this and any other information you can shed on this. I just think this is
Toss a couple things out, Catherine, if I may, while you're on the phone. And
sure.
You can tell me if you think I'm crazy on this. First of all, are you familiar with the book Diagnosing Jefferson by Norm Legend?
I think I've heard you mention it before.
I strongly recommend you get it. Now, it's about Asperger's, which is part of the autism spectrum. But for a kid who's nonverbal, you know, that's a little farther down the autism spectrum than typically Asperger's is. Although they're, you know, it's not inconceivable that Jefferson didn't speak well, at least, or didn't speak at all in his first few years. Certainly we know, you know, Einstein didn't. But in Diagnosing Jefferson, Norm Legend, who himself has an Aspie kid, came to the conclusion, reading Jefferson's biographies, that he was a classic case of Asperger's. And I think that you could build a strong case that Albert Einstein was, too. Many of these kids in the autism spectrum aren't just suffering from problems like, you know, verbal processing. They're also geniuses. They're brilliant.
Right.
And in some cases, you know, there's a huge body of evidence that Mozart had autism. And his genius came out musically. Now, it didn't come out other ways. He was socially maladaptive, but he came, you know, he was a genius. And so this is part of my rant about our school system not recognizing, you know, areas of genius, areas of competence. You know, there's probably a little bit of Aspie in me. There are... I think that there's an absolute need for us to be recognizing the gifts that everybody has and figuring out ways to teach to those gifts rather than saying, like, you know, Arnie Duncan does and all these guys, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, oh, here's the standard that we call intelligence. And if you can fit into these 300 questions on the standardized test that's sold by George Bush's brother for millions of dollars in our school systems, then you're smart. And otherwise, you're disabled. And you end up with kids who are really bright being in kids who are being in classes with kids who are mentally challenged. And it's frustrating for both of them. And they need different kinds of education. Am I making sense, Catherine?
Absolutely.
Okay.
He made 2 points from a perfect SSAT score, and he still couldn't get into these schools.
Wow.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Sorry, Catherine, for the guy stepping on her voice, but thank you so much for your call.
Thank you so much.
Great to hear from you, and keep it up. Being the mother of a child, a special needs child, is no easy job.
Ain't that good news, man, ain't that news. Ain't that news, ain't that good news. Man, 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 ain't that news. My baby's coming home tomorrow.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Ain't that news? Yes, let's get into the news. This Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the efforts to free America's newest political prisoner, former Governor Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. You can sign the petition asking President Obama to pardon Don Siegelman at donsiegelman, that's I before E, dot org. And Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, in the studio with us.
And by the way, Governor Siegelman's children do credit the Tom Hartman Show for really pushing up that petition. So if you haven't signed it, go
good.
Do it.
Good.
Okay. So Governor Romney today was in Springfield, Virginia, not very far from Washington, his only campaign event of the day, which means he's probably in Washington, D.C. and its environs raising money from Republicans and lobbyists and things like that today. They want to do a clear, big television push. But anyhow, he talked about sequestration, and he said that it's a strange proposal in the first place. It's even stranger that it's being put in place. He said, how in the world, as Commander-in-Chief, you can stand by as we shrink our military commitment financially is something I don't understand.
Wait a minute, wasn't Paul Ryan one of the leaders this week, the sequestration thing?
Well, he did actually come up with that. That's right.
And he was on the committee that
well, that's why we're not hearing a lot from Paul Ryan. That's why he was in Tennessee today. But he then said, this is Governor Romney, I want a military so strong no one wants to test it.
Well, I think we already have that, don't we?
I think we have enough bombs to obliterate the world many times over.
We do, yeah.
Then he had 42 Medal of Honor recipients, not all of them with him, but he announced today. And
it's Romney.
This is Governor Romney. And he also said that under his administration, health care for veterans is going to be easy to obtain.
Now, wait a minute. He wants to cut Medicaid, and Medicaid is an important part of TRICARE, particularly for retired military. He wants to block grant that to the states.
But veterans are going to have an easier time getting. I mean, it's most ludicrous. Well, he didn't say, because this wasn't a Q&A with the press.
Well, and he never says anything. He doesn't lay out specifics.
And if
claims.
I were the debate person, that's the first thing I would step on. But
yeah,
but
that's going to be very, very interesting.
Okay, so then...
If you don't mind my interrupting, what's your take on how these debates are? Both sides are trying to lower expectations. What's your sense
That's right. And, in fact, today on the plane today going to Virginia Beach with the president, the administration was saying, look, we're not going to give our debate strategy, obviously, to the other side. The president is studying, and the Romney administration won't say much. So neither side is saying a whole lot except that they want to show their vision. And
well, Romney has come out and said that he expects the president to lie.
Right.
I've got that clip.
Yes.
In fact, we played it earlier.
Yes.
That Obama, he didn't use the word lie. He said how do I say this, doesn't always tell the truth, or worse than that.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
And actually, there have been a bunch of news organizations that have asked that fact-checkers actually sit in the debate and fact-check as each person is talking and put that up on the screen.
It's gotten that bad.
That has been a proposal to the debate commission.
You know, they never would have had to do that during the Kennedy-Nixon debates.
No.
You know, no matter what you thought of Richard Nixon, he debated Jack Kennedy based on what he thought was true.
That's exactly correct. And now it's all, you know, what you want,
Now it's the what talking points were best poll tested by Frank Luntz.
Yes, exactly. So some other things going on today. The president they actually had this gaggle on the route to Virginia Beach. And Jen Psaki is the person who actually speaks for the campaign. Very little is actually said by the press secretary, Jay Carney, although he did say something today. Today, absentee voting started in Virginia. Early voting is actually happening today in Iowa. So first state to do early voting. It's interesting. One of the things that they talked about today, and this was Jen Psaki, she talked about Romney having a Pinocchio nose. She said that if you look at the truthfulness of their record, she said that she's going to say it one more time. If Mitt Romney were Pinocchio, his nose would be reaching from Virginia to Ohio with a number of lies and untruths in the ads that his team has put out.
Remarkable. Well, it is rather disproportionate when you look at the pants on fire.
Hey, look at Josh Mandel, my cousin in Ohio, and some of those
he's
ads.
Just making stuff
and
up.
And Karl Rove is just pushing money into that race.
Yeah, and we know from watching Karl Rove over 40 years of his political history, truth is not a high value for him.
Other thing that Jen Psaki said today was in terms of the Republicans, and they're trying to make absolute hay when it comes to the situation in Benghazi. She said, look, the same briefers that briefed the president also briefed the Republican leadership. They've had plenty of time basically to ask questions. She didn't say it quite like that. They are trying to make political hay out of this when they got exactly the same briefings that the president
In other words, Mitch McConnell and John Boehner knew exactly the same thing the president
That's Obama exactly did. What. Same briefers, same information.
Wow. Were those briefings given to Mitt Romney?
This is not a well-known fact, but as soon as somebody is declared a candidate, they actually do get the same kinds of briefings, maybe not as frequently, that the president gets so that they are on equal footing during the campaign. So, yes, candidate Romney does get pretty much what the president gets in terms of briefing.
Wow.
And that has happened in every campaign since for eons.
Okay. So what else is up?
Okay. There was some protests this morning at Fannie Mae headquarters, there were five people arrested. They were shouting all kinds of things about greed with Fannie Mae and talking. This is about the foreclosure issue,
right.
Wanting really Fannie Mae to be much more responsive.
You know, one of the things I think a lot of people don't realize is the president actually passed out billions of dollars to help states help people refinance their houses. And like Chris Christie in New Jersey, I think he got $400 million.
Right.
And instead of giving it to homeowners, he said, oh, look it, we can balance our budget now. And he just threw it into the general fund.
Right. And nobody's going after him for that.
Right. Why, why Americans don't know this just makes me crazy. Anyhow, Ellen Ratner of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
DonSiegelman.org.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Just a couple of quick updates here. Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Did you see where Curiosity, the rover that's on Mars now, we actually put something on Mars, and we all collectively got together and paid for it, and it's doing good science. They have hit pay dirt. I suppose that's a metaphor that could be taken literally. I don't mean it that way, but they found rocks on Mars that were clearly sculpted by rushing water. It raises the question, were there Martians? Did they burn fossil fuels and turn their atmosphere into what it is now? Unlikely, but, it's interesting to speculate. Will we? Might we? Number two, Todd Akin. Remember when he said, when women are forcibly raped, they don't get pregnant because their body produces this magic hormone or something. He has now said that Claire McCaskill, the woman he's running against, Senator McCaskill, was not behaving like a lady in the last debate. This guy just keeps getting Republicans running from him as fast as they can. I don't know how to say it beyond that. It's just, it's really, we're not going to touch that one. And, of course, Fox is still screaming that the polls are rigged, although their own poll shows President Obama winning. But the polls are rigged. Speaking of rigged, Brad Friedman has spent much of his life investigating the rigging of our electoral system in the United States, in many ways finding things that are just absolutely breathtaking and shocking. Brad, bradblog.com, of course, his blog. He's an investigative journalist and founder and editor of bradblog.com. Brad Friedman, welcome back to the program, Brad.
Hey, Tom, how are you, sir?
I am great, but I'll get better. I hope the same is true of you.
Thank you. It is.
So tell me about this guy down in Florida. He's at Mr. Sproul, is it pronounced?
Sproul. Nathan Sproul.
Sproul. Thank you.
Yeah.
Let me let you tell the story. What's going on here?
Yeah, Nathan Sproul is a longtime GOP operative. He was hired by the Bush-Cheney campaign back in 2004, by the McCain-Palin campaign in 2008. He was quietly hired by the Mitt Romney campaign late last year to do voter registration operations around the country. And his company, he has several, but Sproul and Associates is his main one, has been accused year after year, election after election, in state after state, of destroying Democratic voter registration forms, changing addresses, all sorts of things that Republicans used to pretend Acorn was doing. They weren't, but this company is actually doing it. And once again, he's back. Mitt Romney has hired him. And now we have found down in Palm Beach County, Florida, that more than 100 fraudulent voter registration forms were turned in by his company, which is now called Strategic Allied Consulting. And they were hired by the Florida Republican Party, their largest single expenditure, some $1.3 million to this company, apparently for these fraudulent registration forms. And now the Florida Republican Party has fired this company that they said on Tuesday. They said that they only hired them at the request of the Republican National Committee. And I can report late today now that the company, which is also operating in a number of other swing states, has also now been fired by the North Carolina Republican Party. After Democrats were on the verge of blasting North Carolina Republicans for having anything to do with this shady paid political consultant of Mitt Romney.
Now, I remember in the 2004 election, I was living in Portland at that time, as I recall. No, maybe this was the 2008 election, as I recall. And there were two things that caught our attention. One is there were people coming up to folks in gas stations and shopping malls with what they said was a petition to decriminalize pot and or some variation thereof, medical marijuana, whatever it may be, and asking people to sign it. And then after they sign it, they'd flip the page and say, now you need to sign this form, too. And the form that you're signing to was changing your voter, either registering to vote or changing your voter registration to Republican. And
right. They would get their signature on the form, and they didn't know that they were actually changing their voter registration in
right.
the process.
And then the second thing that we discovered when I was living in Portland was that people were finding in trash cans substantial numbers of torn up voter registration forms that had Democratic marked on them, people trying to register as Democrats. This video has gone viral of this little girl, a 17, 18-year-old kid, saying, I'm just registering people who want to vote for Romney. I'm guessing you saw that, too. Is that the kind of stuff Nathan Sproul is doing?
And actually, I think that he was accused of that specific work up there in Portland that you talk about. And this young girl, I've been talking I spoke yesterday with the Colorado State Republican Communications Director, who confirmed that, in fact, this girl you're talking about in this Colorado video, seen on videotape, that she was, in fact, working for a third-party contractor hired by the state Republican Party in Colorado. Now, we have been able to confirm that, in fact, Nathan Sproul's Strategic Allied Consulting, the one that was fired in Florida and North Carolina, is also operating in Colorado. And some of the MO for this company, they had put out ads saying that you will go into high traffic areas, seek out Romney voters, and sign them up to vote. Well, that's exactly what this young lady is seen doing in this
right.
Colorado video.
Although several people pointed out she was wearing a Latter-day Saints ring. She was wearing a Mormon
yeah.
ring. So there was
yeah.
some curiosity about whether she was just, you know, a well-intentioned young Mormon who was trying to help out, you know, her guy at the top of the ticket.
Well, you know, we don't know yet. I'm trying to figure that out. Yeah, she did have a CTR ring, and the clerk of the El Paso County, Colorado, the county clerk of El Paso County, Colorado, is apparently a Mormon bishopric.
Uh-huh.
And so I don't know if those are tied together. I think more of a clue here is the head of the communications director for the Republican Party in Colorado, who told me that he could not confirm, he did not remember, he had to look it up, the name of the third-party contractor who was hired that this young lady was working for. He promised yesterday that he'd get back to me today with that name of that company. He has yet to do so.
Right.
So,
my guess is he will do so on November 7th.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we'll see if he ever does. I think it's going to be Strategic Allied Consulting. That's just my
yeah.
guess.
So
we'll
Brad,
see if they fire them.
Yeah, we're talking with Brad Friedman, bradblog.com. You can read the whole, all the detail, all the sort of details over there as you always can. Brad Blog, a great information source. We have just a minute left. Nathan Sproul's company had turned in 100 phony voter registration, Republican voter registration forms in Florida that got them fired. What were these? How did this come about? How did he do it? What's the nature of this scam in a minute or less here, Brad?
Well, yeah, I spoke yesterday. I interviewed the Palm Beach County Supervisor of Elections, Susan Booker, and she explained that what they were doing was they noticed that all of these registrations were coming in with the same or similar signatures. They were actually changing addresses on those voter registration forms to commercial addresses. And she warned me during our interview that, you know, this means that people may show up at the polling place and find that their address no longer matches, that their registration has been moved to a different precinct, and they will be disenfranchised.
I thought these were Republican registrations. These were Democratic registrations they were messing with?
That's correct. They were changing what appear to be Democratic registrations to other locations, which is going to disenfranchise these people. And by the way, on Monday, Susan Booker called the Secretary of State's office, you know, the ones who have been pretending they need to do this massive voter purge because
right.
they're worried about fraud in Florida.
Right.
That was on Monday. She said, as of Wednesday night when I interviewed her, that the Secretary of State still has not even bothered to call her back.
Wow. Bradblog.com. Check it out. Brad Friedman. Thank you, Brad.
Thanks, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Amazing. And these people are hysterical that one Democrat in Maryland might have voted in two states. Oh, we got voter fraud here. What about election fraud? Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, broadcast on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on SiriusXM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations all across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio, on every U.S. military base in the world, simulcast as television into 38 million homes on Dish Network, DirecTV, and on several hundred cable systems nationwide. More people watch or listen to the Tom Hartman Program on more stations and outlets than any other progressive talk show in the world. Welcome back. Ben LaBolt on the line with us. He is the National Campaign Press Secretary for the Barack Obama 2012 campaign. Ben, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. BarackObama.com, of course, the website. I have a really serious question for you. Mitt Romney, first of all, I'm assuming that you're familiar with the psychological concept of projection. You accuse others of what you're planning on doing.
Yeah, it's sort of the I'm rubber, you're glue concept.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's kind of how you respond to it, which is a tough response. But clip number two here, Shane, this is just a 23-second clip of Mitt Romney talking about what he expects President Obama to be doing in a few days in the debates.
But I think the challenge that I'll have in the debate is that the president tends to, how shall I say it, say things that aren't true. And in attacking his opponents, I've looked at prior debates, and in that kind of case, it's difficult to say, well, am I going to spend my time correcting things that aren't quite accurate, or am I going to spend my time talking about the things I want to talk about? And
now, not only are Romney's ads demonstrably more often knocked down by fact checkers than the Obama campaign's ads, and similarly for their surrogates, I mean, by orders of magnitude, and not only are Romney's statements more often knocked down than those of President Obama, but now he's announcing that he's going to be using strategic deception, shall we say, as a debate technique. Now, I realize you guys are not walking around talking about, here's how we're going to conduct ourselves in the debates, but just in the abstract, how does anyone successfully debate another person who just makes stuff up?
Well, you know, this is sort of the opposite of their convention, right? I mean, the convention was really based on a tripod of lies. The welfare reform attack that President Clinton had said was false, and the architect of welfare reform had said was false. They sent Paul Ryan out to attack the same Medicare savings that he'd identified in his own budget, and to blame the president for the closure of a GM plant that had been slated for closure before the president even took office. So it is a strange tactic coming from their end. I think the other thing they intend to do in the debates is to say that, you know, Mitt Romney landed 35 punches against the president, and therefore he won the debate. I think that's a misuse of the debate if they think that's what the goal is. I mean, I think that this will be a big audience, and it's an opportunity to lay out your plans to create good-paying jobs for the middle class. That's what the president's going to do, and I think they're approaching this in an entirely different way.
We have a long history in American politics of October surprises, particularly on the part of Republicans. I'm guessing you're familiar with the Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, 1968 October surprise. Are you?
Is that the origin of October surprises?
Well, no, actually, if you don't mind, I'll play a short clip for you. This is Lyndon Johnson had actually negotiated peace with South Vietnam in September of 1968. Hubert Humphrey, his vice president, was running for president. He was going to announce it. Nixon heard about it, and the Nixon campaign out of New Mexico contacted the South Vietnamese and said, do not go to Paris. Do not have the peace. We'll give you a better deal. We'll make you rich. Lyndon Johnson went to his grave with this secret. But here's his conversation with Everett Dirksen, the leading Senate Republican and a man of high integrity at the time. It's just a short clip. Here you go, Ben.
Here's the latest information we got. The agent says that they just talked to the boss in New Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And that he says that you must hold out. Just hold on until after the election. We know what Chu is saying to them out there.
Yeah.
We're pretty well informed on both ends. Now, I'm reading their hand, Everett. I don't want to get this in the campaign.
That's right.
And they oughtn't to be doing this. This is treason.
I know.
Everett Dirksen, this is treason. I know. And that just came out 2 years ago when the Johnson Library finally released those tapes. We discovered that Richard Nixon, you know, committed treason, and therefore another 20,000 Americans died, another million Vietnamese. Are you prepared for, is the Obama campaign prepared for any kind of October surprise coming down the road?
Well, I can't say we're anticipating anything of that nature. But listen, I think in terms of the debates, that the Romney campaign has treated October 3rd like a game-changing moment for their candidate. They're looking for a Reagan-like breakout moment. Here at the campaign, we're focused on what we can focus on every day, which is building the best campaign possible and getting the message out about the president's plan to restore economic security for the middle class. You saw that in the two-minute spot that we're up with in battleground states across the country today, the president laying out his plans. I think one difference that you see from past elections is that Election Day doesn't take place just on one day.
Right.
In fact, it started in Iowa today, and you'll see early vote have been week after week in these states. And so we've gotten to a point where every day matters.
Yeah, and absolutely true. Ben, in the minute we have left, what's the main message that you would convey to people who are concerned about the future of this country and this election's role in that?
Well, I think that the economic choice has crystallized, and the economic policy that Mitt Romney has presented isn't a theory. It's something that we tried before and failed. It's that $5 trillion tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans, very similar to those that we passed in 01 and 03, will unleash job creation. And they didn't. They led to the slowest pace of job creation since World War II, and coupled with stripping back oversight from Wall Street, they were a financial house of cards that collapsed and devastated the middle class in 2008. We've made a lot of progress in the past few years since we were losing 800,000 jobs a month, but the fact is we can't stop there. We need to continue to invest in education and research and development and infrastructure, reduce the deficit and balance waste so that we can now restore economic security for the middle class.
Well said. Ben Lebolt, National Campaign Press Secretary to Barack Obama, 2012, BarackObama.com. Ben, thanks for dropping by today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Always good talking with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Back with your thoughts on where this is all going. Is there going to be an October surprise? Or for that matter, on the other side of it, is it just Tweedledum Tweedledee? The good, the bad, and the very, very ranivorously ugly. The good. The Bronx, New York District Attorney's Office. The Bronx DA's office has stopped all prosecutions of people who were arrested at public housing projects for trespassing until more information can be gathered. Why is this a good thing? Because the majority of those arrested were arrested as a result of New York City's controversial stop and frisk tactics. Nearly 15% of all stop and frisk arrests between 2003 and 2011 occurred at public housing complexes, where police arrested anyone who they thought did not live at the complexes and was not a guest. In many of these arrests, the arrested were actually residents of the complexes. Over the last few months, stop and frisk arrests have dropped 34%, thanks in large part to public outcry and court rulings. Kudos to the Bronx DA's office for standing up to the New York Police Department, Mayor Bloomberg, and their abuse of power. The bad. Wilcoxon's Ice Cream. Wilcoxon's, a local ice cream shop in Livingston, Wyoming, refused to sell their ice cream to a Muslim customer. Earlier this week, a Muslim customer in nearby Sheridan, Wyoming, posted on Wilcoxon's Facebook page asking what flavors of ice cream did not have gelatin in them since they could not eat pork. Shortly after, Wilcoxon's replied to the post saying, "We don't deliver outside of Montana, certainly not Pakistan." Wilcoxon's ignorance, thinking that all Muslims are from Pakistan, is bad enough, but denying someone who would have been a faithful customer a product just because of their religion? That's just absurd. And the very, very ugly, Texas State Representative Jim Murphy. Murphy is the latest conservative nationwide to push for more aggressive voter purge tactics. On Monday, Murphy told Think Progress that if he had his way, Texas would, quote, purge the rolls sooner or suspend voters, end quote. And here's the real stunner. Murphy also told the Center for American Progress's Think Progress that, quote, we ought to have a way if someone hasn't voted in some time that you can be put on suspense. I think he means suspended. And you can send them a letter that says, are you still there? Are you still around? End quote. So Murphy now wants to prevent people from voting who may not have voted for an election or two. It's clear that as President Obama's lead continues to grow in polls nationwide, conservatives are doing all they can to prevent Americans from voting. And that is rigging the elections. And that is very, very ugly. By the way, what I just described is also called voter caging. And ever since the mid-80s, the Republican Party has been operating under a nationwide, to the best of my knowledge, nationwide, court order preventing them from doing it. Not that it stops them, but, you know, they're not supposed to. Donald in Aurora, Illinois, listening on WCPT. Hey, Donald, what's up?
Yes, hi, Tom. You know, I caught a tail end of what you were saying, something about the Republican Party, and I believe you mentioned Mitt Romney. They hired this this corporation to create fraudulent voter
voter registrations and stuff.
But to change the addresses of Democratic voters from their actual home address to weird commercial addresses that are, you know, so far away from the, where they actually live, that when they show up at their local voting place, the person will say, well, you're not on our rolls. You're supposed to be someplace else. And then when they show up at that someplace else, the person will say, well, let's see your ID. And the ID shows their actual address, not this, you know, warehouse. And basically, they don't get to vote.
Well, Mitt Romney, too, was involved in this?
We don't have, to the best of my knowledge, any specific evidence that Mitt Romney himself was involved with this. But this was certainly the Republican Party in Florida. And when they got outed on it, when they got busted on it, they fired this guy.
Yeah. Could this be part of that? Could this be related to this October surprise? Maybe they wanted to spring this out on in sometime in October?
I brought this up with Ben Lebold. I know that he doesn't want to get into conspiracy theory stuff or anything. It might sound like it. He doesn't go on programs like this to make news, but to talk about the news. But frankly, I'm of the opinion that we have seen several attempts at October surprises, and one of them, I think, was, you know, what happened in the Middle East that ended up with the death of four of our diplomats. Now, that's possibly a way out there theory, and in all probability, it's just Al-Qaeda. But the whole thing of ginning up these protests, which provided the cover, that came from this movie that was made, this anti-Muslim movie, and we still don't know who funded that anti-Muslim movie. And it wouldn't surprise me at all. It may well not be, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if it was Karl Rove or one of his buddies. And this was their way of trying to cause a meltdown in the Middle East that Barack Obama would have to deal with. I mean, it didn't. This is how they beat Jimmy Carter, right? They cut a deal. Bill Casey went over to Paris and cut a deal with the Iranians to hold the hostages until after the election and, after the Shah fell. And if they could cut a deal with or just provoke some sort of really serious unrest of the Middle East, something that the president couldn't deal with in a nice, neat fashion before the election, then it would provide them with an opportunity to have a never-ending stream of pundits on television trashing the president. And I, you know, during a commercial break last night, Louise and I flipped over to Fox News, and sure enough, there was Sean Hannity talking about how the president had blown this thing in the Middle East with Libya that led to the death of four of our people, and it was all his fault, and quack, quack, quack. And I'm like, geez, you know, is this the October surprise? I mean, is this an attempt at it, or is it one of many? I just don't know, Donald. Thank you for the call. I also, you know, remember when Karl Rove, in the last election, in the 2008 election, when Karl Rove was supposed to testify before Congress, he was under subpoena, he was supposed to testify before Congress, and he ignored the subpoena. Nancy Pelosi famously said that she could have had him put in jail. She could have had him put in jail. She should have had him put in jail. But he ignored the subpoena to testify, and this was in the whole Scooter Libby outing Valerie Plame thing. He ignored the subpoena to testify, and his excuse was that he was in Yalta. He was over in the former Yugoslavia. He was over on or near the Mediterranean. He was in Yalta at this meeting. Well, who else was at that meeting? Saakashvili. Mikhail, I think his first name is, isn't it? Yeah, Mikhail Saakashvili. Saakashvili is the head of Georgia, of the former Soviet state of Georgia. And 3-4 weeks after Karl Rove meets with this guy, this guy basically declares war on South Ossetia and the other little country, the name of which I constantly forget, but these two little countries that Georgia and Russia have been fighting over forever, but that basically were, you know, considered by the Russians to be Russian territory and that the Russians had control over. And he starts this invasion of them. Abakistan? Abkhazia, that's what it was. It was Abkhazia and South Ossetia. And Saakashvili starts this war with these people, which brings Russia in. And what does John McCain, the presidential nominee with just a few weeks to go before the election, do? He starts running around all over the place, and the media is saying, you know, that this is proof that we need to have a good, strong Republican who's strong on defense rather than a Democrat like Barack Obama who has no international defense experience. That was, you know, almost verbatim John McCain's pitch. And I frankly think that Karl Rove set that thing up. And by the way, after Saakashvili got his butt kicked from one end of Georgia to the other by the Russians, who recaptured South Ossetia and Abkhazia, or however you say it, after that happened, John McCain helped pass through the Senate legislation giving Saakashvili $1 billion. Here, you know, have a payoff. Yeah, you know, some of your soldiers died, some of your cities got burned, you got humiliated, they hurt you politically, but here's $1 billion. And you can spend it any way you want. And what do you want to bet that right next door to Mitt Romney's Swiss bank account, Saakashvili has a Swiss bank account? Or right next in the same building in the Cayman Islands, or in the same building in Bermuda, or the Bahamas, or wherever they are. So, anyhow, I have seen this movie before. I've seen it in election after election after election. And when I see something that looks like it, I just think, you know, there's something going on here. I may be crazy, but call me crazy. I don't mind. Andrea in Palm Springs, California, listening on our affiliate in Palm Springs, AM 1450. Hey, Andrea, we have a minute till the break. It's all yours. Andrea?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I do, yes.
Okay. I wanted to find out if you heard about the election fraud in Washington State. A friend of mine who downloaded the Spanish version, they have to vote by mail in Washington State. So we downloaded the Spanish version only to discover that they had excluded all local races and measures, and they even excluded the ballot line for the U.S. representative on the Spanish ballot.
That's really weird. First of all, it's Oregon that has vote by mail, not Washington State. And secondly, Washington State has two Democratic senators and a Democratic governor. I don't understand it.
Well, he said that it's his. He said it was the Secretary of State.
Yeah. Well, I don't know who the Secretary of State is, but it sounds to me like more of a screw up than voter fraud. I may be wrong.
What happened was he also clicked on the Vietnamese language ballot just to see what it came up, and the Spanish language ballot came up. And then he clicked on the Chinese language ballot, and the English language ballot showed up.
Yikes.
And he contacted his state representative, Chris Whiten, and showed her everything.
Uh-huh.
She was outraged. And
yeah. Well, hopefully something gets done. Andrea, thanks for the heads up on that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Sometimes there's conspiracies. Sometimes there's glitches. This might be a bit of both. Who knows? Maybe they hired a Republican firm to do their website.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. By the way, I said precinct committee people get to write the ballot. What I meant was they get to write the party platform. My apologies. Although they have tremendous influence over the ballot because they're the ones who decide who gets to run in the primaries. And if you can, this is what happened in the Republican Party in 2010. Is the Tea Partiers took over the precinct committee positions in at least 70 or 80 congressional districts. And so when it came time to line up who's going to run in the primaries, you know, hey, we can have 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 people running in the primaries. Let's make sure all of them are Tea Partiers. So no matter who wins, it's going to be a Tea Partier who is going to be the Republican nominee going up against the Democrat. Progressives could be doing the same thing in the Democratic Party. And in fact, in some areas they have. But we need to do it in a lot more, frankly, if you want to see any actual change. Mike in Tacoma, Washington. Mike, you wanted to correct me on mail-in balloting. Did Washington change in the couple of years since I left Portland and moved to D.C. here?
Yeah, Portland, Oregon was all mail-in ballots. They went all mail-in a few years back.
Right.
And Washington followed by a couple of years. Pierce County, where I live, was the last holdout. And I live on Anderson Island. And we're completely mail-in over on Anderson Island.
Okay, but is the entire state completely mail-in now, too, the Washington state?
Yeah, the state is all mail-in ballots. Pierce County was the last holdout. They went mail-in about 2 years ago.
Well, thank you for educating me about that. I guess, you know, in my mind, things were frozen in time as of the 2 years ago, roughly last month, when Louise and I moved from Oregon out here to D.C. So, Mike, thank you for that. I appreciate it. And thanks for listening to Talk 1090 there in Tacoma. Much appreciated. Mark in Folsom, California, listening on 1450am.com. Hey, Mark, what's up? Mark?
Yeah. Thanks for taking my call, Tom. I'm calling because I'm really distressed. I usually admire what you and Bernie say,
but
you've been lately talking. Yeah?
Excuse me. It's just I hear that so often. I love what you say, but... So I was just making a joke. I'm sorry. What did you want to say?
All right. Humor.
Yes.
Okay. Well, you're talking about the national debt like it's a problem, and it is not. In fact,
I don't think it's a problem.
Oh, good. Jeez, that's a relief, because Bernie talks about needing revenue to get certain things going, and talking about, you know, falling off the cliff, et cetera, et cetera. That's all.
Well, the cliff doesn't have to do with the debt. The cliff has to do with these automatic cuts, many of them in social safety net programs that will occur after the first of the year. I have no doubt that they're going to resolve that they're going to work through that in the week or two after the first of the year. Make it retroactive. And with regard to the national debt, our national debt right now is about 100% of GDP. Japan's is over 200% of GDP. Israel's is about 80% of GDP. Ours at the end of World War II is 127% of GDP. It's not a big deal. It won't be a big deal unless the inflation rate starts going up significantly. Then it'll become very expensive. But right now, the interest on the national debt is very low. And I agree with Paul Krugman that with interest rates this low and the Fed promising that they're going to stay this way for at least 2 years, we should be borrowing even more money and using that money to build out our infrastructure, both our physical infrastructure, our transportation infrastructure, our electronic infrastructure, and our educational infrastructure, free college for everybody. Build out that infrastructure. That will boost the economy. That will put more people back to work. Those people will then be paying taxes. Tax collections go up. Tax collections are at a 60-year low right now because of the recession. Tax collections go up, and all of a sudden your deficit goes away. That's how Truman and Eisenhower did it.
Yes, and you omit a significant thing, and that is that if you lower the debt, it actually sucks financial assets out of the private sector, and it makes for a big depression. In fact, this guy Randall Ray, he's a professor at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, cites seven great depressions that follow exactly seven great budget surpluses.
Yeah.
So that withdrawal of money, which, by the way, was also the origin of that Cross of Gold campaign that William Jennings Bryan ran, is
yes.
that it anyway. So
he wanted to take us off the gold standard, too. But the point, I don't disagree with you, with one exception. When, like Japan, for example, their 208% or whatever it is of debt-to-GDP ratio is not a problem, because virtually 100% of Japanese debt is owned by Japanese. And in virtually all of the major debt situations the United States was in the past, all of our debt was owned by Americans. And so, you know, we could deal with it in the ways that you've described and paying that.
Well, not only that, Tom, I mean, it's perfectly legal for the Treasury to mint a few trillion-dollar coins tomorrow and pay it off.
Absolutely.
I mean,
you're absolutely right.
It could be gone. I mean, literally gone. We don't need debt-based money.
I know. The Treasury could literally mint 6 or 8 or 10 or 12, you know, $1 trillion coins and end our debt. It could happen tomorrow without the Fed and without any intervention of the Fed. But the point is that because about $3 trillion of our debt right now is held external to the country, we actually do have to pay that back. And, you know, the Saudis and the Chinese
the
and the British.
Of dollars, though? We can make dollars ad infinitum. I mean, Bernie sponsored that audit of the Fed. They made $16 to $29 trillion within 6 months of Lehman's collapse.
Yeah, although keep in mind, all of those were overnight loans. Those were not long-term dollars. There's a big difference between the impact on an economy of an overnight loan and of the creation of currency that lasts for 6 months or a year. And if you don't believe that, look at the history of the Weimar Republic.
Well, okay. But the point there is that the productive capacity of the economy was at its limit. So Weimar Germany or Zimbabwe, you know, post-colonial Zimbabwe, those hyperinflation episodes are the result of an economy at its very limit.
No, it wasn't.
What it could produce.
It wasn't. The way that Hitler got Germany out of that was by building the Autobahns and by, you know, building Volkswagens and things. I mean, Hitler created industry. I mean, he did it as collaboration between corporations and government. That's what fascism was all about. But he put people back to work massively. Read the history of the mid-1930s, and he was incredibly popular for it. He was a crazy guy, but it, you know, got him on the cover of Time magazine twice. Mark, thank you for the call. Coming up tomorrow, it's Brunch with Bernie. America's Senator Bernie Sanders will be taking your calls. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.